Well, for the next month or so, we're going to be going through a series which has the theme of stewardship. And the reason why I wanted to do this, there are a number of reasons. There are some practical reasons in terms of addressing these issues in the life of the church. Talking about issues like money and possessions and time and how we steward these things are not always easy to talk about as a pastor, because there are many, and understandably so, you hear about pastors who misuse and abuse the pulpit for their own gain. Maybe some of you heard about that prosperity preacher who asked his followers to contribute to a $56 million personal jet, right? And it's not the first one. He has a number of, I think it's like third or fourth one. And when people hear stuff like that, they're like, see, there are these guys that want people, they just fleece people so that they can have their own personal kind of desires met. I mean, I don't know why you need four jets. You know, I'd be okay with one, but four, you know? Don't worry, I'm not asking you to get me a jet. But it's understandable that people get cynical when the preacher starts talking about things like money or so forth, because you can't help but feel there's an agenda there. And I do want to challenge you. There are a number of topics in Scripture that are uncomfortable for the preacher or the pastor to talk about. Things like submitting to leadership is another one. You know, people can't help but go, oh, he just wants us to do whatever he wants. No, that's not the case. We have to go through Scripture and see the things that God calls for us to heed. And in fact, this issue of stewarding what God has given to us in our lives is something that should really, really be considered seriously, because it's something that Jesus talks about almost more than any other topic, practically speaking. And so for Jesus to address it means it's probably something pretty important for us to consider because of what Jesus calls for us to do. Now, if we just take some time to reflect on why are we here? Like I want to ask you, why are you here? Not at church, but why are you here on this earth? What are you living for? I'm like, what do you wake up for and say, you know, today is worth living for because I'm going to do this. I'm going to pursue this. Why do we do all the things that we do? Why do we go to school? Now, for those who are younger, they'll say, because I have to. You know, I don't have a choice in the matter. My parents make me go to school. Well, you know, actually, I guess you're supposed to go to school in some way or form if you live in this country. Then you get a job and you say, so why do I work? And some of you, now that, you know, those of you who maybe just got jobs, you went through the thrill of searching for a job and the anticipation that comes with going to interviews and waiting for, you know, a call to say you got the job, or you get disappointed because you didn't get the job. A lot of drama, but then when you finally get the job, you're excited because you're like, okay, maybe this is going to fulfill me. And then some of you find out, I think I've talked to some people, it didn't even take a week after they got their job for it to hit them that this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. You know, and then this sense of like doom, you know, kind of hits you, because you're like, it's almost like a prison sentence. You're like, I have to work for the next 40, 50 years of my life, and that's it. And then you engage in recreation, socializing, I mean, all of it. The question is, why do you do it? And along the way, you have, in a sense, in your hands, various things that are at your disposal. Money, possessions, time, gifts, talents, relationships, anything from family to getting married, having children, to extended family, to friendships, to people in your neighborhood, to the church, people you meet at the workplace or at school. There's so much in terms of the opportunity to have relationships. But what do you do with all of it? You know, do you ever feel sometimes a bit overwhelmed thinking, I'm not sure how to handle everything? And for some of us, you go to school, you finally get the job, and then you start getting a paycheck, and now you're starting to make decisions as to how you're going to use that money. Do I buy a house? Okay. You know, I know a number of people who've just recently gone through the house buying process, and it's not easy, right? Angela and I have gone through it 6 times, and it has not been always a pleasant experience, right? Depending on the market, and you know, when you buy, when you sell, and all the complications that come with stuff like that. There's a lot to have to deal with. If you had a chance, and let's just say take everything you have in your life, okay, everything, think about it, just make a short list, and try to put a money value to it, okay? Try to put a money value to it. Now, you know, if you don't have much, like Olivia, okay, she doesn't actually have much that's her own. I mean, she's received it all, right? She doesn't have a job. She's going to school, and but she's sort of in process, kind of the way we all were as well. You go to school, you wake up every morning, you're not sure why you have to keep going to school. Why do I need to learn Latin? I mean, isn't Latin a dead language? No, it's still alive because you have to learn it, right? And she just finished 7th grade, so there's still 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade. Before you get to college, year 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5, 6, 7, right? And then maybe grad school, 1, 2, 3, right? And then you're like, and then finally maybe a job, and then you realize a college graduate doesn't make too much. You know, you might end up working at Jamba Juice because you can't find anything, right? But let's take all of that for some of you. Now you've gone through some of that. Put a money value to it all. You don't have to tell anyone, okay? And it's not what you just think it is. You know, some of you are like, it's worth squat. No, but just kind of think. And let's just say one day you're walking along. You're just taking a walk. Kind of like back in the times of Jesus, you know, there's just dirt paths, and you're cutting through a field because you need to get somewhere, and as you are cutting through this field, you know, you trip over something, and you're like, what is this? And you see that there's something sticking out of the ground, so you start digging, and you're like, what am I doing? Like, why am I digging? But you see something. There's, like, something unusual. You see, like, the corner of a box, and you're thinking, huh, this might be something. So you dig more, and you bring out a box, and you find out that this box is filled with gold. Gold. And you look around, and you think, did anyone see this? Now, this field that you happen to be going through belongs to someone. And there's not much. Okay, there's just not much on this field. But this field does not belong to you. It belongs to the owner of this, you know, property. But you realize they don't know. You realize they don't know that there's this treasure in their field. And it would be wrong for you to take it because that would be stealing. It doesn't belong to you. Because you might think, well, nobody knows, right? I can just take it. No, God knows. So you think, okay, this field, you do a quick assessment of the property, you're like, this property doesn't seem like it's crazy, you know, expensive, but it's probably a lot more than I would normally consider. So you go and you actually meet the owner and you say, hey, would you be interested in selling your property? And they're like, well, you know, maybe for the right price. And you go, what's the price? He says, well, I'll sell it to you for $1 million. $1 million. Now, you know in that box there's more than $1 million. But you need to find a way to buy this property. So what do? Okay, now remember how much you assessed your life? Like, whatever you own. Okay, let's take your car. Probably not worth that much. Okay. Maybe some of you own a home. Maybe some of you have some jewelry. Maybe some of you collect things that supposedly have value. And you realize you're a little short. You're like 900,000. So you need 100,000 more. So you start looking at everything else you got. Everything. And you dig through your whole life. And now you can come up with another 100,000. But if you sell all of it, you are left with nothing. Okay? You sell everything that you own. You the only thing you literally get to keep are the clothes that you're wearing. You have to give every penny. Okay? You have to give every piece of property. You have to give everything that you have of value so that you can buy this field. You got to give it all up. Now, would you be willing to do it if you knew that that treasure, let's just say for the sake of illustration, was $1 billion? A billion. But you'd have to give up everything for that billion. Would you do it? Would you do it? Yeah? Okay. Some of you would do it. Some of you are hesitating. You're like, there's got to be a catch. There's something that's going to, I'm going to get nailed on this. No, no. All you need to do is pay the $1 million. But that means you have to give up everything you own. Everything. There is a moment in time you have literally nothing except just your clothes. Okay? But there's the promise that once this transaction comes through, you're going to eventually be able to get what? James was the first one to raise his hand. $1 billion, okay? Because he understands the value of $1 billion, right? $1 million, $1 billion. How many of you would choose $1 million? Don't raise your hand. Because we would look at you and go, you fool. Why would you settle for $1 million when you could have $1 billion? Well, look at Matthew chapter 13, verse 44. This is Jesus speaking, and he says this, "The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in the field, which a man found and hid again, and from joy over it goes and sells all that he has and buys that field." Okay? So remember, Jesus would share these stories, these parables, and these parables have a primary lesson. It's not that every detail necessarily equates to something, but there's a point to the story. He says, the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field, which a man found and hid again, and from joy over it, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. Okay, so it's just like the scenario that I just painted for you. He's walking and he trips over this box and he finds this treasure and he realizes nobody knows about this. Maybe there was a rich person walking through years before, maybe decades before, and he hid it for some reason and he died, so nobody knows about this treasure. And the owner of the property doesn't know. I mean, if he knew, if you owned that property and you knew that, wouldn't you have already taken it by now? Of course you would. Now, he wants to legitimately be able to get it, so he has to sell. It says there, all that he has. All that he has. So he could buy that field. Now, some of you might get a little excited and say, oh, if that could only happen. If that could only happen to me, I'd be so happy. Well, would you? You know, maybe if it was money, some of us would get so excited about this that the prospect of being able to be extremely wealthy would make me happy. Well, why do you think Jesus tells this story? Well, let's go back to Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 to 21. And this is going to be sort of what sets the tone for everything we're going to be talking about in the next few weeks. Matthew 6, verses 19 to 21, says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in or steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Now, we've actually here at Lighthouse LA, we went through this passage back in 2016. Do any of you remember? Do any of you remember the title? Okay, I didn't either. I had to go back and look. And the title was something like, What's Your Precious? Do you remember? And I talked about Lord of the Rings and Gollum and his precious the ring, right? My precious. Well, so we talked about this a little bit going through the Sermon on the Mount, but I do want to come back to this particular passage in Matthew 6, verses 19 and 21, to set the tone for how you need to consider all of your life. There's pretty much two choices you have here. You will either store up treasures for yourselves on earth, or you will store up your treasures in heaven. There's only two. There's only two options here. Everything that you have that God gives to you, you need to consider that a stewardship. God is the one who gives it all to you. What you do with it is up to you. You could either store it up for yourself on earth, because you can't store it up for yourself in heaven. That just doesn't work. Or you can store it up in heaven for the sake of God's kingdom. So there's two points I want to challenge you with today. First, don't settle for the temporal. Don't settle for the temporal. Verse 19 of Matthew 6, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal. When Jesus says, do not store up, this is actually a command. It's not just a suggestion. And the idea of storing up literally comes from this idea of building up a treasury. It's almost like if you had a basement at home and you had a vault, all right, and you started storing all the things that you would consider to be valuable. So what would you put there? For me, I think the only thing I really have of value that I consider valuable are my books. I have a lot of books, maybe 15,000 books or so. And some of you, you're like, what are books? I have an app. I have a Kindle. I read articles on the internet. But, you know, in fact, I was talking about this with someone. I think it was Jimmy Kimmel who went out and just asked people, can you give us a title of any book? Any book. And so many people were like, And I was like, oh my goodness. I mean, this is like the end of the world. Like, how dumb are we now that we can't even name a title of one book? And the only books that some people, or the only titles some people come up with were titles of movies. Because people watch movies, right? And that was a book, right? That was a book, wasn't it? Yeah, well, a lot of these movies are based off of books. But you know, I can understand why some people go, books aren't treasure. I mean, what a waste. What a waste for someone to have a lot of books. Well, you know, I suppose when I die, my legacy I leave for my kids is, sorry, girls, you get a lot of books. Some daughters might like it, and some daughters might not care for it. But at least I consider them to be valuable. What do you consider to be valuable? And why is it valuable to you? Because the question that we have to ask ourselves here, when Jesus says, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth Do we really look first to the fact that there's something about what it is for me that's involved? You know, things like money and material possessions, they're not bad or good on their own. It's what's at the heart of how I look at it. And when we take all the things that we have an opportunity in life to start to gather, and you start investing it in some way or form, are you doing exactly what Jesus tells you not to do? When Jesus says, do not store up for yourselves treasures for yourselves on earth. And then he says, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. Now, back in those days when Jesus is talking, this is something that was very real and something that people considered to be valuable were the clothes. You know, back then they didn't have too many outfits. You only had so many outfits. They didn't have like Macy's, okay, where you can go and have multiple outfits and you mix and match and you have your seasonal wear and you got to get your matching accessories and all. That's us today. Okay, back then it's like if you had like two outfits, wow, you're pretty good. If you had like three or four, you're wealthy. And maybe sometimes you might have had a chance to go to like Egypt or something. So you got some like glittery clothes. Woo! You know, when people see you, they're like, wow, you get them from Egypt? Yeah. Yeah. There's a store right by the pyramids, and just went and grabbed some clothes there. Well, back then, there were moths too. Have any of you ever had moths get into your clothes? Yeah? Maybe some of you don't know how this works. They just appear somehow. You're like, all of a sudden, one day, you go into your closet, and then you'll pull out a sweater. I had this happen. I had a nice sweater that I used to wear back on the East Coast. And one day, I pulled it out, and there are holes in there. It's like, who ate my clothes? I know Angela doesn't eat my clothes. My kids, maybe, but, they couldn't reach the top of the closet there. No, there are moths, right? And that's why you have to get things like mothballs or whatever, because somehow moths find their way, even though you don't see them. And I hate that, because there's nothing you can really do. Moths will come in and get your clothes. Rust, you ever have something rust? You have some metal things, and you don't use it for a while, and all of a sudden you look at it, and you're like, what's this stuff on there? What's this like orangey stuff that's like building up? And you find out that it's ruined now, because it's rusted away. The same things happened back then that they do today. Have any of you ever had a thief break into your house and steal something that belonged to you? Now, this is something that is just so, it's so horrible. In college, I was living at UCLA in the Christian fraternity, and one day someone came into our rooms and it stole my wallet, which was right next to my, it was like on my nightstand. So they came while I was sleeping and took my wallet. I remember I was so angry, like the audacity that someone would walk into my room while I'm sleeping, take my wallet. If I had woken up and caught them in the act, you know what I would do to them? I could think of so many things to do to them. Because that's just so wrong, right? I mean, why do people do that? In fact, isn't it sad that there are some people who take all their intellect and all their mental capacity to find elaborate ways to break into homes? Like they spend so much time. And now we got things like these video cameras where you can talk to them. Any of you have that where you actually catch someone and then they're trying to take those packages? People take packages. We've had packages taken from in front of our house. And, I remember asking a police officer, if I caught them, could I do something? And he said, well, I wouldn't recommend it. He said, it's for your safety too. But I was like, I didn't tell him this, but I was like, I have a sword. I could just sort of cut his Achilles, keep him from running, and then that way we send him to jail, right? Well, these things happen. So sometimes when we set our hearts on all these things, that we save up clothes, material possessions, and then someone takes them away or they're ruined, Why does that happen? It's because they're temporary. They're not lasting. And if we tie our sense of importance or our sense of value into these things, what are you saying about what you truly value? You're putting your heart into things that don't last. 1 John 2:15 to 17 says, "Do not love the world nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the boastful pride of life is not from the Father, but is from the world. The world is passing away and also its lust, but the one who does the will of God lives forever." You see, it's what you love in your heart that gets revealed. You know, when you watch little kids, isn't it interesting, like when you bring families together and little kids come play together, and say it's at your home, so it's your kids' toys. And so when other kids come, what do? They want to play with your kids' toys. So they'll pick up any random toy. But what usually happens? That's your kid's favorite toy, or at least for the moment, because they're like, "Do not take my toy. That is my toy." So they start arguing, fighting over this toy. So they're willing to sacrifice a relationship over a toy. That's what you see it happen all the time with little kids. Or maybe like when your siblings, you know, and your sibling comes in your room and borrows your clothes without asking. So you get really angry. "How dare you borrow my clothes? That's mine!" And so there's a break in relationship because of clothes, which next year you don't even wear anymore, right? But you're willing to fight to the death for that one item of clothing, right? Because what it shows is you actually love these things more than the people. And I don't think it changes, because our heart is so set on things. But then God's word says, the world is passing away, and also its lust. But the one who does the will of God lives forever. Turn over to 1 Timothy chapter 6. And when Paul is talking to Timothy, and it's really in the context of Paul saying, "Timothy, as you're to be this minister for the sake of the gospel, you are here to do God's work. There are certain things that you need to be aware of." And in 1 Timothy 6, 3, he talks about those who advocate different doctrines and those who don't agree with sound words. And these are the kind of people who are conceited. They don't understand anything. They have morbid interest in controversial questions and disputes. And he goes on, and verse 5 says, "There's constant friction between men of depraved mind and deprived of the truth, who suppose that godliness is a means of gain." So what he's talking about is, yes, there are those who try to take ministry and use it as a means of gain. So they will even talk godly. They'll even promote godliness, but it's really just a means to make money for themselves. But then Paul says this, "But godliness actually is a means of great gain," verse 6, "when accompanied by contentment. For we have brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either." Now think about that. When you were in the womb, did you think in the womb, "You know what? I got some good stuff in here, you know, in this uterus. I got this umbilical cord. Man, that's a lifeline. It's bringing nutrients, and, you know, that's how I'm staying alive. I got to hold on to that umbilical cord. And, you know, this sack that I'm in, oh, nice and warm, cozy." I mean, are you thinking that as you're born? You know, and you're like, "Why are you taking it away from me? Why did you pop the sack? Why am I now having to go through this birth canal that's reshaping my head so I look like an alien? And you just cut the umbilical cord. You cut it." I remember cutting Jenna's. I just started cutting it. And I was like, "Whoa, that's crazy." It was the first experience. So I just remember thinking, like, she is now on her own. Right? I mean, she doesn't get that lifeline anymore, right?
It's kind of a, sorry, Lily, you know, it's, I don't want to make this sound all weird, but you don't leave that umbilical cord there, you know, attached to the placenta. I'm sorry, you know, you're not dragging around a placenta all over the place with you. For those of you who don't know all this, go back to your, you know, high school bio kind of thing. No, you didn't come out with anything, and you weren't even conscious of this. But think about it. When you die, as you're about to die, you know, are your last thoughts like, I got to make sure I take the right things into the coffin? I mean, I'm going to be in this thing for a long time, so what would I want in my coffin? I mean, would you really think that's the most important thing for you to think about? No, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You didn't bring anything into the world, you're not going to take anything out of it either. But if you have food and covering, with these we shall be content. Food? Did you eat? Yeah, most of us eat. You got clothes? That's why in Matthew 6, when Jesus says, God takes care of the birds of the field, right? They're fed. God takes care of the flowers of the field. They're clothed. Why are you anxious? But seek first his kingdom. Okay, look, go back to 1 Timothy 6, verse 9. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. So here's the challenge. Okay, if we're really honest here, don't raise your hands though. Have any of you wanted to get rich? I have. I'll be honest. I wish I could get rich. I would have dreams. I think I've shared this before. Where someone would send a check in the mail, and I'd open it, and it would say $1 million to John Kim. And I'm like, wow. And then in my dream, I go, this is a dream. And I wake up. And it's so disappointing because it's like, even in my dream, I know it's a dream. This is not true. This is not real. There's no way someone just randomly sends you a check for $1 million. It just doesn't happen. But it sure would be nice. Right? I mean, that's why there are so many get-rich schemes that people put together, because it appeals to this desire to want to get rich, whether quickly or whether it takes some time. But here it says, but those who want to get rich, okay, so it doesn't matter whether it's slow or fast, fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires, which plunge men into ruin and destruction. Now that sounds overly dramatic. Some people might say, that's not me. I'm not like crazy wanting to get rich. I just want to be able to say I'm, you know, somewhere a little bit above medium, you know, upper middle class. Not on the upper middle class, but just upper middle class. I'm okay with that. I mean, I don't want to be poverty level, right? I mean, I don't know how many of you have these thoughts when you think about this kind of stuff, but especially say when you get married and you start making decisions as to how you will spend your money. And then in verse 10, for the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. See, here's the dangerous side of it. And I think you don't have to look too far to see people who fit into this. It's the love of money. Money is not the root of all sorts of evil. It's the love of money. And because of the longing for it, the constant longing for it, there are those who've wandered away from the faith. Now, that doesn't maybe always appear so dramatically, in a catastrophic way. I think for many, it's a slow erosion toward that end. It's because that's where your heart bent is. So you keep going, and it takes you away, further and further away from the faith. And then it says, they have pierced themselves with many griefs. And then Paul says, but flee from these things.
Flee from these things, you man of God, and pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, perseverance, and gentleness. Fight the good fight of faith. Take hold of the eternal life to which you are called, and you made the good confession in the presence of many witnesses. Do you see? You got to flee from that kind of thinking. And you got to understand that it's a fight. You're fighting the good fight of faith. And when you flee, not only do you flee from something, but you pursue. You pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, perseverance, and gentleness. In essence, you could say, flee from sin and pursue Christ. Don't love the world. Love Christ. Is this what governs your heart? Because if you just seek the things of this world, you are investing in something that will not last. It's all going to pass away. All of it. Go back to Matthew 6, verse 20 and 21. It says this, "But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in or steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Second point is invest in the eternal. Invest in the eternal. Just as there's a command to not store up treasures for yourselves on earth, there's an accompanying command. Store up. This is what you should do. Store up for yourselves treasures in heaven. The idea here is that you have eternity in mind as you consider what you will do with all that you've been given. Now, there's a great little book, and I want to recommend it to you. It's called The Treasure Principle by Randy Alcorn. And he has a very just straightforward principle that he shares, which is called The Treasure Principle, and it's this. And write this down, or type it into your phone. You can't take it with you, but you can send it on ahead. Okay, here's the treasure principle. You can't take it with you, but you could send it on ahead. This is the treasure principle. All that we've been given, and you can say these are the treasures that God has bestowed upon us. We can either use it for ourselves, but why would you use it for yourself if you can't take it with you? But you do have the choice to invest it for eternal purposes. This is the difference between seeking first your own kingdom or seeking first God's kingdom and his righteousness. And really, this flows out of your heart. Because Jesus says, where your heart is, there will your treasure be also. Okay. In other words, when you think about the things that you see are valued, they reveal where your heart really is. You reflect what you really love. In fact, you reflect where you find your greatest joy. Go back to Matthew 13, 44, the parable. Remember the guy who found the hidden treasure in the field? What was his response to finding that treasure? One word. There's one word there. How did he respond? He had joy. Is joy good? Are you sure? Is it enough to sustain you to be willing to sacrifice? Because that's what this guy did. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in the field, which a man found and hid again, and from joy over it, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. It's out of joy that he is willing to sell everything. It's not out of duty. It's not out of obligation. It's because there's an overwhelming joy that he sees is so surpassing to anything else that he might have to go through so that he can get that treasure, he is willing to then endure whatever it takes to get that treasure. Look at Hebrews chapter 11 to give you an example. Verses 24 to 27. Hebrews chapter 11, it's called the Hall of Faith. These are all the Old Testament characters who are examples of those who live by faith. Right? Hebrews 11, 1 starts off with faith is assurance of things hoped for and the conviction of things not seen. So if you're living by faith,
What you're saying is I'm not living for what I immediately can get here, but it's something I see down the road, but I can't even see it. I trust God for it. Moses was such an example. Look at Hebrews 11:24. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. And look at verse 26. Considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen. Now this is a very, very incredible example when you think about the story of Moses. What drove Moses to go through all the suffering that he went through when you think about it? Now if you read the story of Moses, what did he have to give up? One of the movies that my girls really enjoyed is The Prince of Egypt, right? Prince of Egypt. The story of Moses. And there's songs that they still remember from that movie. Because it presents a very distinct picture. Moses was adopted by Pharaoh's daughter. So in other words, he now no longer is a slave. He is part of royalty. Okay, royalty, slave. If you could choose, which one would you choose? Would you choose to be a slave or royalty? I think if we're honest, most are like, royalty. Why? Because then I get everything. And I can tell the slaves what to do too. I mean, I get it all. But Moses, when he grows up, he refuses to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And then it says here, he chooses rather to endure ill treatment. He is willing to suffer being treated badly, because he has aligned himself with God's people, the Israelites, rather than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. But even more than that, verse 26, he considered the reproach of Christ. In other words, because he, you could say, is saying, I'm a Christian, I will take what comes with that, and I am willing to suffer for the sake of following Christ. He considers that to be greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. Okay, so here's another question. Suffering, riches, treasures, gold. Suffering, gold. What would you choose? I mean, most of us would probably go, I know the right answer. It's supposed to be suffering. But it doesn't sound so appealing. I mean, how can suffering be riches? How can it be not only riches, how can it be greater riches than the treasures of Egypt? Well, it's all a matter of perspective. Moses is looking to the reward. What is his reward for choosing to have the reproach of Christ? You know what was part of that reward? Or part of getting to that reward? It was spending 40 years with a bunch of complainers. 40 years. Now, the only way I can sort of think about what this would look like would be going on a missions trip with all of you for 40 years. 40 years, okay? Can you imagine being together for 40 years? I mean, most of us were like, I can handle one time a week with some of these people at church, because I don't have to deal with them then the rest of the week. But if I had to deal with them every stinking day, because it's literally stinking for them. Remember, they're in the wilderness. It's hot. I mean, it's nasty. Can you imagine being with people that complain? I'm hungry. I mean, that's where the whole hangry thing came from back then, right? They are angry that they don't have leeks and onions. They're like, Moses, you brought us out here so we could starve? We had it much better in Egypt. Hello, you were slaves in Egypt. You'd rather go back to being a slave? And you can see someone saying, yes. I mean, how sad is that? But you know what? What if we were there? And you had to decide between, am I going to trust that God is going to provide food every day? And what's he providing? Manna.
What's on the menu today? Manna. Breakfast? Manna. Lunch? Manna. Dinner? Manna. What's on the menu for tomorrow? Manna. 40 years of manna. Right? I mean, how many of you just go, that's it, that's it, I'm done. I don't care if, I don't want to be part of God's chosen people. I get chosen for manna. How is this a good thing? And then they say, well, we want meat. We want meat. Moses, give us meat. So God tells Moses, okay, I'll give them the meat. So what does he do? He rains meat on them. Like quail. Quail's just dropping out of the sky. Can you imagine? I mean, that would be just as crazy. You're just like, meat, meat, ah! You know, and then what's on the menu for tomorrow? Quail. Manna and quail. Manna and quail. Quail and manna. Quail and manna. Manna. 40 years. Would any of you complain because of that menu? Oh, yeah. We would complain big time. And not only that, Moses messes up once. He messes up once, right? Instead of talking to the rock, God says, just talk to the rock. Rock, water will come out. He hits the rock. Because the other time God told him, he told him to hit the rock, and it looks more dramatic, right? When you hit the rock, you know, like, bam, and the water goes like, see? But if he just says, water, it doesn't bring much for him, right? But God says, you didn't give me the glory. So Moses, you don't get to go into the promised land. Oh, man. But you know what? There was still something greater than getting into the promised land for Moses. Not getting into the promised land, that was not the worst thing. He had something greater. He was looking to a reward that transcended anything here on this earth. He could have gone into the promised land, and if he went into the promised land, he would have just died there too. There was something greater than the promised land. It was God. God was his treasure. You see, what are you living your life for? I mean, how we complain reveals a lot about us. It's because we make it about us. We're storing up treasures for ourselves. We're really good at that. I mean, take even how you view relationships. I think if there's one stewardship that reveals a lot about our hearts, it's how you view the people that God has sovereignly appointed to be a part of your life, even the difficult people. And you might say this, I didn't choose them. Oh, well, okay, you know what? God chose them. But I had no say in this. Why do you act as if you have some sort of authority here? Everything you have is because it was given to you. All the good things that you have was given to you. All the other things that you might not consider to be good, God has a good purpose in them for you. Do you steward that? Do you steward that in a way that shows that you see everything is from God and that in how you respond to it? You know, that's why you go back to the issue of money. And Pastor Amos Yang came a couple weeks ago, and he gave a really, really wonderful sermon on that, just the importance of giving. But it shows how you view God in the midst of it all. Turn over to 2 Corinthians chapter 9, and I want to reiterate some things here just briefly. Starting from verse 6. Now this I say, he who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and he who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Each one must do just as he has purposed in his heart, not grudgingly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that always having all sufficiency in everything, you may have an abundance for every good deed. As it is written, he scattered abroad, he gave to the poor, his righteousness endures forever. Now he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. You will be enriched in everything for all liberality, which through us is producing thanksgiving to God. For the ministry of this service is not only fully supplying the needs of the saints, but is also overflowing through many thanksgivings to God. Because of the proof given by this ministry, they will glorify God for your obedience to your confession of the gospel of Christ and for the liberality of your contribution to them and to all, while they also, by prayer on your behalf, yearn for you because of the surpassing grace of God in you. Now, what's Paul talking about? He's talking about the fact that these churches, the Church of Corinth was part of this, they were contributing to the needs of the saints in Jerusalem, and a lot of poor people in Jerusalem. If you recall at Pentecost, when all the Jews come from all over the world to celebrate the Feast of Pentecost, many of them get saved, and they settle in Jerusalem. They don't have anything. They've left everything behind. And so many of them don't have much already, so they need to be taken care of. So Paul goes around and shares that there is this need, and these churches are contributing. But notice what he's saying to them, essentially. You are investing through your giving in liberality, in your generosity. And what do you get in response to that? You will see a harvest of righteousness. You will see a harvest of thanksgiving. Now, how many of you, if you were to say, okay, let's say the way you see missions, you say, well, I'm going to contribute $10 to missions. I want results. Okay, so we come back and we give report of the Czech mission trip, which we'll do at the end of summer. And we'll say, you know what your investments, what they've brought about? A harvest of righteousness. You know what else we harvested? Thanksgiving. And you might go, I put in $10 for Thanksgiving. I mean, where were the converts? At least I should get one convert out of this. I put $10. Okay. Did you even share the gospel with them? Yeah. What we have to bring back? Thanksgiving. God's righteousness has been proclaimed. Yeah, I think some people have this weird sense where, like, if I'm giving something, I need to see a return in a way that makes sense to me. But do you see what God's saying here in his word? Your investment, even through finances, is so that kingdom work can be done, so that there would be a harvest of righteousness and thanksgiving. But do you value that? Do you see that as fruit? Now, he sums up this portion in verse 15 of 2 Corinthians. It says this, thanks be to God for his indescribable gift. Now, just so that you make sure, you have been given a gift beyond description, and that gift is Christ. You have been given so much that you could never, ever pay back in any way. You know, if God were to say, so what do I get out of my investment in you? I sent my son to die for you, so what do I get out of it? A bunch of complainers, people who are preoccupied doing their own thing, people who are building their own kingdom. You think God might say, what a waste of my son. You see, if God thought the way we did, that's what he would do. But God doesn't think that way. God says, I'm willing to sacrifice my son for something greater. For the salvation that glorifies God's work. There's nothing greater. So the bottom line question is going to be, do we see our lives in the same vein? All that we've been given from God, do we see it as an opportunity to bring glory to him? We have been vested with everything. So, the time that you've been given, who's it for? The money that you've been given, who's it for? The material possessions that you've been given, who's it for? Everything that you have. Now, just so that you understand, some people hear this and go, so you just want me to be a beggar? No, God never says that. There's no, like, vow of poverty you need to take. We're not saying sell everything, wear a potato sack, and go live on the streets. You know, some people say stuff like that as a reaction. That
That has nothing to do with what God's asking you. That's just a selfish reaction. What God's saying is, are you going to use your life for his kingdom? Are you going to take everything, because it doesn't belong to you. Remember, it's a gift from him. It's a stewardship. How do I use it for the sake of his kingdom? Well, in the coming weeks, we're going to talk about this. We're going to talk about things like, how do I use money, material possessions? Like some of you who've been buying a home, and some of you have already shown this to be very true. You're using your home for the sake of the kingdom. So you host things. You have people over. You some people I know, and even through the history of pastoring, I've been so amazed at seeing how many people are willing to open their home in a hospitable way to even strangers, missionaries, people who couldn't afford things, but you're willing to take them in. That's using your home for the sake of the kingdom. How about your time? How about your job, your schooling? How about your gifts, your talents? And how about your relationships? How do you see that all as a stewardship? Because all of it has been given to you from God. But we see that in light of the greatest gift that he's given to us, which is Christ. Because Christ is that greatest treasure, and ultimately that's the treasure I'm looking for, okay? To see Christ. So in getting there, are we willing to be like Moses, who says, I'm willing to consider the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt? In other words, am I willing to suffer now for the sake of something greater later? Am I going to take this treasure principle that Randy Alcorn talks about? You can't take it with you, but you can send it on ahead. So the thing is this, you should store up treasure. It's not saying don't store up any treasure, but store up the kind of treasure that's going to last. I'm going to ask you to bow your heads now as we prepare for communion. Maybe for some of you this morning, you're not a Christian, and you're thinking, okay, you know, this pastor must have some angle. He just wants my money. I don't want your money. It's not your money. If there's anything I could say I would want, but not for me, it's your heart for God. To say that you would see Christ as your greatest treasure. I mean, what in this world will last? Nothing. So why would you place so much value? Not only that, you have to consider the fact that you are someone who is facing eternal condemnation and judgment. And at the heart of that is because you don't love God. You love yourself. You love the things of this world. You are complete opposition to everything that God represents. That's why Christ came, to provide salvation, to save us from our condemnation, so that we would receive forgiveness, because his death pays the penalty for our sins and restores us to a right relationship with God, so that we would be able to live in a way that truly reflects what's worth living for. As we take the elements of the Lord's table, we do so because it all comes down to that. We look to Christ as the greatest treasure. He is the one for whom all things are worth giving up, to sell all that we have so that we might have the greatest treasure in Christ. If you're a Christian here this morning, take some time to consider, how are you stewarding all that God has given to you? It's all a gift from him. Are you using it for the sake of his kingdom?
Or are you just storing up treasures for yourself here on earth where there is no eternal value? It's something that we're all challenged and tempted to give into. But this is why we need to be reminded of, is Christ truly that indescribable gift? And do we thank God that we have been privileged to receive such a gift?